Oh, hi, guys.
Hi, everybody.
I was trying to say it like you would do it again.
Oh, hi, guys.
Yeah, I can't do it that well.
Oh, hi.
I'm Sarah.
I'm Alicia.
And this is Sinister States. So,
back to our regularly scheduled episodes.
Yes, with state. But hopefully you guys enjoyed the special episodes with the Nickelodeon Quiet on Set and the John Wayne Gacy and even a little bit of Guam.
Guam.
And it was a little bit of a different week, but hopefully you guys liked that. We enjoyed doing it.
I definitely did. It was fun.
It was a little bit easier to talk to than...
It's...
talk about.
Yeah. See, it's not just me today.
No. I'm tired.
I'm tired, three.
I didn't say I was tired, too.
I'm just saying. I'm like three levels of tired right now.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
But we are... Did I just kick something?
Nope, that's my window. It just creaks and cracks. And
oh, okay. I'm
just waiting for the glass to shatter out of it someday.
Jeez, that scared me. I was like, what did I bust?
Oh, yeah, no, nothing. Nothing, but let me tell you what I busted.
Here we go. What'd you break?
So on Thursday. So I'm not tiny, right? Okay, you see me. I'm not 100 pounds. Okay.
You're not 100 pounds either.
No, but I'm saying, like, you see that, right? Okay, well... I went to the chiropractor on Thursday, and I've been to this guy probably 40 times at this point. Mm-hmm. And he has you do a specific type of traction where you lay on a table by yourself and you put this like weight over your head and it like stretches your neck and stuff. Well, he has four different tables that you can utilize. And when I go with Lewis, I use one specific table that's next to Lewis, and I've used it 15 times. It's old school, so it's made out of wood, but these are like doctor's tables. Like, they're meant to hold like a lot of weight because you can't guarantee that a patient is always going to be tiny.
Mm-hmm.
So I was getting up from using it and it snapped on the one side. And I was like, what just happened? And we looked, and we're like, huh, okay, we'll tell Doc when we're done. Like, we'll tell the receptionist when we're done, because we didn't realize that there was another person coming into the room. So this man is small, probably 175, 200 max, and he gets ready to do his traction. We don't know this man, right? And he uses that same table. And Lewis and I both just say, you might want to get off of that. And he was like, what? What's going on? What's wrong? And we're like, it's about to give out, like, where you're sitting. And he was like, oh, man, like, look at this wood. Oh, I would have fallen right on my ass. And so we get up to leave to go be adjusted by the doctor who isn't there yet. And we tell the receptionist, our friend Winnie. I said, Winnie, one of your tables is broken. She goes, what do you mean? And she goes in, she goes, yeah, that's definitely broken. Are you guys okay? And we're like, yep. So Doc comes in like 2 minutes later and he's like, hey, can somebody help me move the table out? But yeah, it literally broke. Thankfully, it didn't break all the way to the floor, but it broke.
I've never broke a table, but I broke a chair.
I've never broken anything like that before.
You know, like the little cheap, like plastic chairs like you get at Walmart to sit in, you know, the plastic patio chairs.
Yeah, the ones that have like no adjustable like arms.
Right, it's just solid plastic and you hope and pray that your butt fits in the seat.
Mm-hmm.
350 pound Alicia broke the leg off one of those. Listen. And I folded up like a pretzel in it too.
Oh man.
Because the leg went and it snapped off.
Oh my gosh.
Back.
I have two.
So it happened.
I have two broken chair stories. One of them happened to me when I was in third grade, and I was not a huge child, but in third grade, do you remember those old school, like, bucket chairs? They came in different colors and they were plastic.
We have some of those at the church for the kids.
Yes. Okay. Well, they, for some reason, thought it would be a great idea for us to switch classrooms to go be taught by other teachers in third grade.
Mm-hmm.
So I go into this third grade teacher's room, and the only chair left is this green chair. And I start to sit on it. And it is, like, already broken. So basically, the back legs, somebody had sat in it or moved it, and they were becoming straight, like up. And I was sitting in it, and I kept leaning further and further forward because the leg kept moving further and further close to my legs. I'm not explaining this well, but I just remember 1 minute I was sitting on this chair, and the other minute I was sitting on the floor, and you just heard bang, and I'm on the floor with this chair, and the legs are not broken, like they didn't bow out or anything, but they clamped together and like folded up. And I was in third grade. I was 8 or 9 years old, and that happened to me. And then when Lewis and I first got together, one of his friends came to our house to play video games or something. And he sat in one of our dining room chairs and he broke it. Like, just the leg just phew, right out from under
I
there.
lost a wheel on my chair one time at work. Do you ever have that happen? I'm
No.
sitting there and the whole wheel falls off. It just,
And then you're like, oh.
it's, yeah, you go all
Oh
upside.
my gosh,
Now, the
no.
most embarrassing thing that I have ever to this day had happened to me, I was in ninth grade, so my freshman year of high school.
See, I told you, there's nothing going on out there.
Things are getting weird, like high school itself is weird. Do you remember when the Birkenstocks like came back in style and they were really
Yes,
popular? And
with the socks.
yeah, I did not have Birkenstock money, but my parents had Faded Glory money,
Yeah.
okay? So I had the Faded Glory version of them.
Hey, you only knew they were Birks when you took them off.
Right. So mine were slick on the bottom though. I don't know if you remember that. They had like that felt like material on the bottom, you know,
Yeah.
and they were slick. My high school gym, they had these big wooden bleachers and they would like fold out and then they would fold up to be put away. Like they would fold out,
Yeah.
unravel, basically. Those things were slick, okay? And we used to just walk up the wooden, like we didn't go up the
Yeah,
steps. You just
no.
walked
If
the
it was
wood.
cooler to do the wood.
So, well, and at this time we were doing a pep rally. At the school, you see where this is going for the big football game. And everybody's just walking up, you know, to get a seat because you wanted to sit with your friends, right? I go to walk and I get about halfway up the bleachers. Both my feet slide out from underneath me in my Faded Glory stocks. And I go
My
down.
faded glory.
go down. It's the whole flipping school.
Oh
Fell in front of everybody at the school
my
in my fake Birkenstock, my Faded Glory stock.
Dude, there was one time. Okay, we should stop telling stories soon because I have so many. There's one time in middle school. Do you okay, maybe not you specifically, but did you ever have those kids that like you would play volleyball or something in school and they would lower the net and everybody tried to jump over it? No, okay, so that was like a thing. Like
I hated sports,
when we
so.
were done playing volleyball or whatever, badminton or whatever in school, they would lower the net for whatever reason. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, everybody else, all my friends are jumping over that. I ran to jump over it and my foot got tangled in the netting and I fell flat on my face in front of my entire gym class, which was like 30 kids.
Wow.
And that was funny. And then when I was really little, you know the metal bars that separate the doors at grocery stores, or at least they used to. I don't know of any grocery stores here that have any. Well, I remember thinking I was so cool. I was gonna play get there first or whatever, like race my little brother to get to that bar. And I didn't realize that there was a bar before it. And I ran chest first into that bar and fell on my behind when I was like 6 or 7 years old.
Listen, it happens. We all have that story where we go down.
Yep,
It's
so,
embarrassing.
yep.
This has absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking about. We squirreled so far.
Well, you said break and I broke a table and here we are.
Yeah.
So, anyway, we are in Massachusetts. Say it the way that you say it.
Massachusetts.
See, you don't say it weird.
Massachusetts.
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 Yeah, it's normal. So we're in Massachusetts. We're going to start off with our missing persons again. So this one is going to be Jane Chelsea Doe 2000. She was found November 13th, 2000 in Chelsea, Massachusetts. Her estimated age is between 17 to 25 years old. So on November 13th, 2000, an unidentified female was found deceased in a parking lot on Crest Ave in Chelsea, Massachusetts. She had been deceased for approximately 24 hours. The victim is described to be a medium to light-skinned black female with possible admixture of Asian, Cape Verdean, or Indian. She was 17 to 25 years old at the time of death, stood 5'2" to 5'5" tall, and weighed around 100 to 130 pounds. She is described as petite with good muscle tone. The female had short black hair with a reddish tint. No obvious tattoos, scars, or identifying marks were observed on her body. She did have purple polish on her toenails. She had been treated by a dentist in life as several fillings were observed in her teeth. She also had a slight overbite that might have been noticeable to others. Massachusetts State Police have identified and arrested a suspect in the female's homicide. The suspect stated that the victim was involved in sex trafficking at the time of her death, claimed she identified herself as Lisa, and was from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Images above are a facial reconstruction created by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children forensic artist that depicts what the female may have looked like in life. So that is a Jane Doe from Massachusetts. Dun, dun, dun. And obviously, Alicia will post photos. So,
unless it's like our last Jane Doe, I hope it's like our last one. We didn't even get to post her and they found out who she was.
Yeah. So,
that was pretty sweet.
I know. So, we are again in Massachusetts, and I am going to bring us the, I don't know if I'd say infamous, but infamous Jane Toppin.
I've never heard of her.
So AKA Jolly Jane.
Never heard of her, so she's not too notorious for me.
No, I guess not. So
I'm excited to hear this.
Okay, great. So I'm going to jump.
You're like, between, okay, great.
Yeah, I'm going to jump between two different things that I have here because I have my notes, but then I also found this cool, like, timeline of events thing from. This timeline of events is from. Radford University in Radford, Virginia, the Department of Psychology. She's a serial killer. She was researched by Emily Allen, Elena Averill, and Emmeline Cook. So I don't want to take credit from this timeline, but I'll be using it because it's really nice and I like it.
Go for it.
Okay, great. So Jane Toppin was born Honora Kelly to Peter and Bridget Kelly on March 31st, 1854.
Oh, snaps, her birthday's tomorrow.
Oh, happy birthday, Jane.
But should we really tell her happy birthday? Probably not.
No. Her mother, Bridget Kelly, died of tuberculosis when she was very young, and her father, Peter Kelly, was well known as an eccentric and abusive alcoholic, nicknamed by those who knew him, Kelly the Crack, as in crackpot.
Wow, okay, yep. There we go.
Yep. In later years, Kelly was said to have sewn his own eyelids closed while working as a tailor. So her daddy. Interesting.
That sounds like dad's elevator was hung up between the basement and first.
Yep. It says that many have said that eventually he went insane while working at a tailor shop and was institutionalized by trying to sew his eyelids shut. An alleged cousin later reported that Honora, aka Jane, also had an older sister named Nellie who went violently insane in her 20s and had to be institutionalized as well. So,
wonder if it's schizophrenia.
Maybe. Psychosis runs in the fam.
Well, a lot of people, because you're talking about her sister was kind of later in her life, you know, a lot of times schizophrenia doesn't hit people until their late 20s, early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's just maybe.
No, you're good. So, at the age of 6 in 1863, again, we're in the 1800s, so we're...
Ooh, you took us to... We went in the way back machine!
Yes. So, in February of 1863, Peter Kelly begged the Boston Female Asylum to take his two youngest daughters, Honora and 8-year-old Delia Josephine. When the board examined the shabby dress and poor hygiene of the young girls... It was decided that these children had been subjected to neglect and possible abuse, and the vote was unanimous to allow the children to stay at the asylum. So she ended up at the Boston Female Asylum, and it was an orphanage for indigent
Indigent, yeah.
female children. And he just left them there and never saw them again. So that's kind of crummy, but no records exist of their experiences during their time in the asylum, but reportedly Delia became a prostitute
That
while their
escalated
older sister
quickly.
Nellie again was committed to an insane asylum. So all three girls were sent to different places and led very different lives. So in November of 1862, less than 2 years after being abandoned by her father, Honora was placed as an indentured servant in the home of Mrs. Anne C. Toppin of Lowell, Massachusetts. Though never formally adopted by the Toppins, Honora took on the surname of her benefactors to distance herself from her former family and eventually became known as Jane Toppin. The original Toppin family already had a daughter named Elizabeth, with whom Honora was on good terms at the time.
You're like, at the time.
Yeah, at the time. So Jane, between the ages of 7 and 16, so she was adopted when she was 7 in 1864, Jane suffered shame and humiliation at the hands of her foster mother. Although Anne's daughter Elizabeth never mistreated Jane, due to the abuse at the hands of her at the hands of Mrs. Toppin, Jane developed a bitter hate and jealousy for her foster sister. Most of all, Jane envied the fact that Elizabeth would eventually get married one day. According to unsubstantial love stories, Jane was once courted by a Lowell office worker who even gave her an engagement ring engraved with the image of a bird, but the relationship soured when he moved to another town and fell in love with his landlord's daughter, a young woman who he eventually married.
Oh, wow.
But in 1885, Jane began training to be a nurse at Cambridge Hospital. Unlike her early years, where she was described as brilliant and terrible, which makes no sense to me, at the hospital she was well liked, bright, and friendly, evoking the nickname Jolly Jane. Once she became close with the patients, she picked her favorite ones, who were normally elderly and very sick. During her residency, Toppin used her patients as guinea pigs in experiments with morphine and atropine. She altered their prescribed dosages to see what it did to their nervous systems. However, she spent considerable time alone with patients, making up fake charts, medicating them to drift in and out of consciousness, and even getting into bed with them.
No.
Yeah, she was a little creepy.
Why?
Yeah. Also, I forgot to mention this, but again, I'm going between two different sources, and I did not put two and two together, because I'm bad. But
You're not bad.
because she was abused by her foster mother, again, she was of Irish descent, Irish Catholic descent. In order to overcome this abuse, Jane developed a vivacious personality and denied her Irish heritage by making derogatory anti-Irish and anti-Catholic statements in the Protestant circles in which she moved. While some of her schoolmates liked her a great deal, others despised her as an outrageous liar. She spun tales of her heritage and would often pin her troublesome deeds on other children. Due to her unhappiness with her situation and the unlikelihood that she would never marry, Jane grew unattractively plump.
So they're trying to say that she got fat and
And ugly. Yeah.
they're being bullies.
Yeah.
They don't know her.
She was also released of her duties with the Toppin family and received $50 as stipulated by the indenture agreement at the age of 18. Because again, she's an adult. She doesn't need to work for them anymore. And although she was released from her indentured obligations, she did remain in the Toppin household for a whole decade. So until 1885, when she went to become a nurse. And she worked for her foster sister, Elizabeth. After Elizabeth's mother died. And while there, Elizabeth married Orimel Brigham, a young deacon in the local church. Excuse me. Okay, so now we are back. So, hang on. So sorry. Okay, so I'm back to after she was experimenting on her people. It says that it is speculated that Jane killed more than a dozen of her patients while working at Cambridge. One patient, Mrs. Amelia Finney, lived to later tell the tale of Jane's maliciousness. After a surgery, Jane administered some bitter-tasting medicine to Amelia to help her with pain. As she was slipping into unconsciousness, she realized that Jane had gotten into bed with her and began kissing her all over her face. Luckily for Mrs. Finney, Jane was startled by someone and hastily left the room. As Amelia gained consciousness the next day, she thought the incident had all been a dream, and she checked out of the hospital, keeping her fears silent until she found out that Jane had been arrested in 1901. So, there is one person that can attest to her creepiness.
Ooh.
Yeah. So.
You just gonna be climbing into bed with people?
Yeah, she a little sus. So. Even though her colleagues did not like her that much, she won the favor of a couple of doctors who gave her glowing recommendations to receive wider training at the more respectable Massachusetts General Hospital. In 1889, she did claim more victims before being fired from Massachusetts General Hospital. And then she briefly returned to Cambridge, but was soon dismissed for administering opiates recklessly. Jane then began a career as a private nurse and flourished despite complaints of petty theft. Well, so that's got fun.
Sticky fingers too.
Yep.
There we go.
Yep. So that was a whole thing. Okay, so in her leave of absence from like nursing in a hospital, she was Hang on. I just lost it. Oh, yeah. So she went into private nursing. Over the summer, she did break an important rule, and she did leave one of her patients' homes without permission. So she was discharged from private nursing. She went back to Cambridge and did the same thing over the summer as well. Because this was all, I mean, she was fired, but this was all during her nursing education.
Yeah.
So she left a ward without permission while she was working at Cambridge. And she was then discharged again from, she wasn't discharged, I'm so sorry. But she did not ever receive an actual nursing license. And she did pass the final and she did have a signed diploma. But because of her inability to stay in private nursing currently and then work at the hospital, you know, she never got her actual nursing license. So, she's back at Cambridge. She's back at Cambridge. She was, again, administering opiates recklessly, and there were rumors that she was purposely harming her patients, and some of them were even dying under her care. Like, other nurses were starting to notice. So, once again, she was, however, sorry, before I move on, this is between the ages of 34 and 35, where in 1891, she was regarded as the most successful nurse in Cambridge, both private and in the hospital, but she did ultimately decide to shift her career from hospital setting back to private nursing, because people were talking. Because
she killing everybody.
Right. So even though she was a successful private nurse, some of her employers were annoyed with her intricate lies and petty theft that she continued to do. But in her free time, she liked to guzzle beer, tell lies, and spread rumors. That was just what she
She's a monster. Yeah. Oh, girl.
Yeah. So in May of 1895, Jane started her whole spiel on murder.
Murderers.
Yeah. So she was between the ages of 30 and 39. 1895, May of 1895. Jane poisoned her landlord, Israel Dunham, a white male, age 77, because he was feeble and fussy. Jane then moved in with her dead landlord's wife, Lovey.
Oh, she gonna kill Lovey. Lovey's gonna
Yep. Go in next. The fall of 1897, Jane poisoned Lovey Dunham. And then in August of 1899, Jane's foster sister Elizabeth Brigham met her at a vacation home at Cape Cod. Jane slowly poisoned her and claimed that was the first victim that she actually hated. Jane told Elizabeth's widower, Oramel, that it was her sister's last wish for Jane to have her gold watch and chain. Oramel obliged because this sounded characteristic of his dear wife, Elizabeth, and later found out after Jane was arrested that she pawned the gold watch and the chain. Then on December 29th, aka my mommy's birthday of 1899, Jane poisoned Mary McClear, a white female, age 70, after she was recommended by the woman's doctor to take care of her. It was speculated that Jane took some of Mary's clothing. This murder was odd because Jane did not know Mary personally, and she liked to kill people that she knew. Yeah, she's one of those weirdos. So, on February 11th of 1900, she killed an old friend named Myra Connors with strychnine in order to take over her position as dining matron at the theological school.
What?
Then, also in 1900, after Myra died, Jane approached the dean of the theological school and informed him that Myra was planning on going on a sabbatical, and she had intended to recommend Jane for the job. Jane lied to the dean and told him that Myra had instructed her on all of the duties of the job. The dean offered Jane the job, and right from the start, her co-workers questioned her competence. During the summer, while the theological school was out of session, she worked at the mess hall of the biological school in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. In November of 1900, Jane was dismissed from her job at the theological school without claiming any victims for financial irregularities and complaints that had been lodged against her. Then, in 1901, Jane began living under new landlords Melvin and Eliza Beadle, whom she also poisoned, but only enough to give them gastrointestinal illness.
She's just gonna give you the upset tummy.
Yeah. So, Jane poisoned the Beatles' housekeeper, Mary Sullivan, enough to frame her as a drunk so that she would be dismissed and Jane could take over, and it worked.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Then, between June and July, the landlord of the cottage where Jane vacationed decided that it was time to collect the $500 that she owed them, so Mary Alden embarked on a trip to the Beatles' house in Cambridge. Jane gave Maddie some doctored mineral water, and later that evening gave her morphine when she became sick. Over 7 days, under the noses of everyone, even a doctor who had been successful in catching another woman serial killer who used arsenic, Jane poisoned her victim, catching another woman. Oh, I'm sorry. Jane poisoned her victim slowly. She played with Maddie, bringing her in and out of lucidity, only to immediately plunge her back into a deep coma. Mm-hmm. Then, on July 5th, Maddie, a.k.a. Mary Alden, Maddie Davis, finally died. So, she was alive for a week going through this. And then, later on in July, Jane moved in with the Davis family to help take care of Alden Davis after the passing of his wife. Less than a week after she had been there, Jane set fire to some papers in a closet in her new home. Jane. But much to Jane's dismay, the fire was quickly extinguished.
You just like her daddy.
A few days later, Jane lit a fire in the pantry and went out for an afternoon stroll. Fortunately for the Davis family, friends saw the smoke and rushed to put the fire out. Then the following week, again, we're all in July of 1901. The next week, Jane set another fire in the Davis home, but once again, it was extinguished in time. Then on July 26, 1901, Jane poisoned Genevieve Gordon, the youngest Davis daughter, who had remained in the house to make sure that her father would fare well without his wife. Jane tried to pass this off as a suicide due to the fact that Genevieve was so distraught over her mother's death. Then, on August 8th, Jane turned her sights on Alden Davis and killed him in less than 2 weeks after his youngest daughter's death.
Gosh, she killing everybody.
Yep, she went fast. August 12th to 13th of 1901, Jane successfully poisoned the last of the Davis family, the oldest daughter, Minnie Gibbs. While Minnie was dying, Jane brought her 10-year-old son to bed with her, and it is unknown if Jane sexually abused the child.
Oh, no.
Yep. On August 26, 1901, Jane returned to her hometown of Lowell in hopes of marrying her dead foster sister's widower, Oramel Brigham. Jane killed his sister, Edna Bannister, a white female aged 77, because she felt she was in the way of her marriage to Oramel. Then, on August 31st of 1901, Minnie Gibbs' father-in-law, Captain Gibbs, summoned Leonard Wood, the leading toxicologist in Massachusetts, to exhume the bodies of the Davis family to test his suspicion that they had been poisoned. Yep.
Get it, dude.
Jane read this in the newspaper, and when the bodies were exhumed, a state police detective, John S. Patterson, was assigned to follow Jane and keep an eye on her. On September 29th, 1901, frustrated that all of her attempts to win Oramel were not working, she even poisoned him and nursed him back to health to prove how indispensable she was. Jane took an overdose of morphine herself. After Jane was back on her feet, Oramel promptly kicked her out. Jane then traveled to New Hampshire to visit an old friend, Sarah Nichols. On October 29th, 1901, Jane was arrested for the murder of Minnie Gibbs. During the time that Jane was awaiting a formal trial, she remained in the Barnstable jailhouse. She quickly befriended the jailer's wife, who believed that Jane was innocent. As she sat in her jail cell, Jane gained more and more weight. Then, on October 31st, 1901, arraignment was held for Jane. The trial was continued until November 8th, where Jane pled not guilty. The state proposed that Jane had been using arsenic to poison her victims because it has been found in multiple bodies. However, it turned out that the embalming fluid used was mostly arsenic, and the prosecution was at a standstill about how Jane had actually killed her victims. It was old Captain Gibbs, aka Minnie Gibbs's father-in-law, who proposed that Jane had used morphine and atropine as her poisons of choice. The November 8th trial was continued into November 11th. The prosecution was still no closer to connecting Jane to the victims. An inquisition hearing about the deaths of the Davis girls was held after Jane's hearing, and Captain Gibbs' suspicions were founded. On November 11th, 1901, trial once again continued until December 11th. On November 21st, the bodies of Maddie and Alden Davis were also exhumed. On December 6th of 1901, 23 members of a grand jury assembled to hear Jane's case. Jane was officially charged with 4 counts of murder of the entire Davis family. Once again, she pled not guilty. On March 31st, 1902, papers reported that Jane had undergone a psychiatric evaluation by a panel of experts who had determined that she was insane. Jane had admitted that she had an irresistible sexual impulse to kill, and she confessed to 11 murders. On June 23rd, 1902, the trial of Jane Toppin began. It took less than 8 hours for the entire trial, and the jury only had to deliberate for 20 minutes. Jane was found not guilty by reason of insanity. Jane was sentenced to Taunton Insane Hospital for life. Jane appeared to be overcome with joy about the verdict because she assumed that she would be able to convince the hospital of her sanity and be set free in a few months' time. It was later discovered that Jane had confessed to her defense lawyer and longtime friend James Stewart Murphy that she had committed more than 31 murders. In addition to this, as a supplement to the New York Journal, William Randolph Hearst typed up Jane's confession. In this document, Jane admitted that she wanted the panel of psychiatrists to find her insane. Upon convincing them of this lie, she felt very smug in knowing that she had outsmarted a panel of quote-unquote experts. Jane described the exquisite pleasure it gave her to kill her patients, and she marveled at the lack of feeling and remorse she felt by doing these horrible things. In an attempt to show that she was not without feeling, Jane claimed that the jilt she received from the lover in her youth seemed to be the root of all of her problems. Jane explained, quote, "If I had been a married woman, I probably would not have killed all those people. I would have had my husband, my children, and my home to take up my mind." On June 24th, 1902, Jane checked into her new home at the Taunton Insane Hospital. And for 3.5 decades, Jane's mental state slowly deteriorated. For a time, she refused to eat any of the food at the hospital because, ironically, she thought that the food had been poisoned. As the years passed, Jane became a quiet old lady who did not cause any trouble. She died on August 17th, 1938, of old age at the Taunton Insane Hospital.
Wow.
And that is Jolly Jane Toppin.
That's a wild ride.
Yeah, she got real quick with her killings, too.
She's just killing everybody up in there.
She really was. And that's what she looked like.
She wasn't ugly.
Nor was she really fat. So I'm confused. But yeah, so that is Jolly Jane Toppin.
She was just pleasantly plump.
Yeah, but I thought it was crazy. I don't really do medical murders on here. I do it more so on our Patreon. But I figured because Massachusetts came up and I was like, that's a good one to do.
It is. Thank you so much. She was wild.
I know.
She just killing everybody. She don't care if you're a kid, you're an adult. She don't care. She gonna take you out.
Yeah, and I don't know what it is about women poisoning people. I feel like every woman serial killer we've had has poisoned people. Right. Except for the one that I had on Patreon where she starved people to death.
Yeah. She gonna make you starve to death. Yeah. What was her name?
I forgot.
Oh, she had the whole... I covered her on my podcast too.
Did you really?
Because they say the place is super duper haunted. Mm. They say you can still hear people screaming.
That's awful. I don't remember her name. I forgot. Helen something? Well, anyway, hopefully you guys found that interesting, though.
I did. Thank you so much.
No problem. You know I always got you.
I'd never heard of her, so I always like it when I get to hear something that I've never heard before.
Yeah. No, I loved it. But thank you guys so much for listening. Please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and our Patreon, as well as if you have any stories or anything for us, send us an email at sinisterstatespodcast@gmail.com.
Yes.
Otherwise, do you have any parting words for the fans?
Just lock your doors and don't play with Ouija boards. Back to the same old same.
Yep. And as always, there's probably something sinister right in your own backyard.
Bum, bum, bum.